Our study tonight is out of Leviticus chapter 21, verses 1 to 24, heeding God's graduated standard of expectations for His servants. Graduated expectations. In other words, expectations that vary in degree of expectation based upon the role that a person has. We believers relate to one another so that the higher our role in God's biblical assignment of oversight or exampling, the greater our accountability to the Lord, be it a family, in a church, or in society. It reminds me of a passage in Luke chapter 12. The servant who knew his Lord's command and did not do it would be beaten with many stripes, but the servant who did not know his Lord's command would be beaten with few stripes. In other words, there's an accountability there based upon insight. But there's also accountability based upon role. This need for a graduated standard of expectations for God's servants relative to their role before others is taught in Leviticus chapter 21, 21-24, and it provides us an effective practical application as follows. And I'll read the verses as we go. The Lord held that the priests were to have a higher standard of conduct than He did for the people in Israel. Let me read verses 1 to 9. This deals with the priests, the general priests. And the Lord said unto Moses, speak unto the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say unto them, there shall none be defiled for the dead among his people, but for his near of kin, that is close to him, that is for his mother, for his father, for his son, for his daughter, and for his brother, and for his sister, who is still a virgin, that is close to him who has no husband, for here he may be defiled. The defiling here is dealing with a dead body. When a person would die, the body would have to be prepared for burial, and people who were next of kin would do this. But the priest could not deal with a next of kin except they were of his immediate family. Verse 4, but he shall not defile himself, being a chief man among his people, to profane himself. They shall not make baldness upon their head, neither shall they shave off the corner of their beard, nor make any cuttings in the flesh. Incidentally, I'll let you know ahead of time, these happen to be practices that the pagans used around them for grieving. When they would grieve in the morning, they would shave parts of the head, they would cut off the corners of the beard and so forth, and they would cut themselves. That would be a sign of grief, deep grief. They were not supposed to do that. Verse 6, they shall be holy unto the Lord their God, and not profane the name of their God, nor the offerings of the Lord made by fire. And the bread of their God they do offer. Therefore they shall be holy, or separate. Then they shall not take a wife that is a cult prostitute or immoral. Neither shall they take a woman who has been divorced from her husband, for he is holy unto his God. You shall sanctify him, therefore, for he offers the bread of thy God. He shall be holy unto thee, for I, the Lord, which to sanctify you am holy. And the daughter of any priest, if she profane herself by becoming a prostitute, she profanes her father's office. She shall be burnt with fire. And we'll discuss what this means. The stipulations of the standards for ceremonial cleanliness for the priests in Leviticus 21 were given in view of the fact that the priests were spiritual leaders in Israel who officiated at God's altar in behalf of the rest of the nation. You see, when people would come in with their sacrifices, their animals or sacrifice, it was the priest who would take the animal, and after it was killed, he was the one who was seen as dressing it and putting the animal on the altar as a man who was operating sort of an intercessory process for the people themselves. So he was viewed as an example, a spiritual example to the rest of the people. So God required that a man like that was supposed to conduct himself in a way that fit the office. So there were restrictions that were laid upon him that were more demanding than if just a regular Israelite. We do the same in our church. The conduct of a man who is a board member or a board chairman or a pastor, greater things are expected of them into their conduct and how they dress and so forth than a person who is not, or a man who is not a member of the board and so forth. It's fascinating. But God required the same in His day. Because of this exemplary role, the priests were to abstain from ceremonially defiling themselves in approaching any dead body, except if the deceased had been a close blood relative like a mother, a father, a son, a daughter, a brother, or a virgin sister. Now, if the sister had been married to another man, then she was no longer viewed as part of his immediate family. She was part of the man's family. This is a patriarchal society, so he couldn't be involved. The man's family would be taking care of the sister. In cases involving all other deceased relatives or other parties, the priest could not let himself be ceremoniously contaminated to uphold his testimony as a holy man of God, called to be committed to functioning as a priest. So verses 4 and 6, he shall not defile himself, being a chief man among his people, to profane himself. In verse 6, they shall be holy or separate unto their God and not profane the name of their God. Now, like the rest of the people, the priest could not practice mourning rites common to pagans. His function in the sacrificial services of the Lord made it imperative that he distance himself from all such pagan rites. Now, we don't have these pagan rites today, such as shaving the edge of the beard and cutting the hair and so forth. But one thing that should be noticed of a Christian, there should be a degree of control even in grief. Now, it doesn't mean that a Christian can't grieve. Obviously, we grieve at the loss of a person like that. But I've been at funerals, of course, as a pastor. I've, conducted many funerals, and sometimes people completely lose it, and they're just bawling openly and incessantly, and that's something that is because they don't have control. When a person is controlled by the Holy Spirit, their grieving is much more subdued than that. There's a rest in the Lord at the time. So I'll never forget when I was in Nigeria, West Africa, there was a man and his oldest son who together drowned in a whirlpool in a river that was not far from the station where we were at. And his wife witnessed the whole thing. I'll never forget that her name was Mrs. Gosen. She was there for the funeral. And, of course, the funeral had to be the very next day according to Nigerian law. We don't have funeral homes like we have here. So they had to prepare the bodies very quickly. And I remember she was at the graveside, and she was there. She was weeping very quietly, but there was no convulsive sobbing or anything like that. And I was just stunned. In fact, it was something that the Lord used as a witness to me that not long after that I accepted Christ as my Savior, because I couldn't understand how this woman had the capacity to stand up under something that she had seen like this. But her son, I think, was in the sixth grade. And her husband, I think he was in his 30s. So we're dealing with a tragic loss of life that she had witnessed. But she was incredibly controlled and never forgot that. But same with us. We need to be people who are people under control. Now also, the priest could not marry a cult prostitute or an immoral woman, nor could he wed a divorced woman in signifying that he was of unimpeachable character. Now, the rest of the people could marry divorcees and so forth, but not the priests. He could wed a widow in accordance with the New Testament rule in 1 Corinthians 7:39. See, 1 Corinthians 7:39 says that a Christian may remarry after he's lost a partner. He may marry a widow or a widower, as the case may be, but only a person who is a Christian in that particular case. Now, this is a very interesting verse. I hadn't noticed this. We had gotten into a discussion not long ago as a board as to could a man who has married a divorced woman qualify to be a board member because he himself had never been divorced. But it's interesting here in Leviticus chapter 20, the passage is very, very clear. Verse 7, they shall not take a wife who is a cult prostitute or immoral, neither shall they take a woman who has been divorced from her husband, for he is holy unto his God. I believe that that sets a pattern for the New Testament elder or deacon because he's supposed to be a one-woman man. The implication is he's supposed to have a lily-white record. And we've already taken the stand that reflects this, and we took that stand years before we came to this passage, which I think is an encouragement to us in the Lord. In Nigeria, West Africa, when we would send missionaries out there, if there was a man who had been married to a divorced woman, the African elders would come to us and say, "Why do you send us your problems? We have enough problems with pagans coming out of paganism. The missionaries that you send us have to be absolutely squeaky clean in their record. Otherwise, it creates a real stumbling block for the pagans and for our trying to disciple pagans." So there were some missionaries had to send back to the States because of, you know, an imperfect marital record, which I think is very interesting. But God required this for these men. Now, 1 Timothy 3:2 says of a deacon, or an elder, he has to be a one-woman man. But it's interesting when it talks about widows who are put on the church roll to be supported in widows. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 9, they have to be a one-man woman. So the widow had to have been married to a man only once in her life. So it looks like what's good for the man is good for the woman. They have to have had one marriage partner. Now, of course, the exception would be as if the partner had died, as in the case of Elizabeth Elitch. I think she's had three or four husbands, but each one of them has died in succession. And so she has remarried, but that's biblical. She can marry as a widow after the husband dies. Now, since prostitution by a priest's daughter undermined the testimony of her father in his office, which was a very serious offense, she was to be punished severely with death by fire, of course, that the Jews took to be by molten lead, as we described last week. And this would clear up the father's reputation so that he could continue ministering. And it would put the fear of God in all of the other Levitical daughters of the priests, that they were expected to live absolutely unimpeachable lives. And then let me skip down before I deal with the high priest. We'll skip down to verses 16 to 21. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron, and saying, Whosoever he be of your seed in their generations that has any blemish, let him not approach thee to offer the bread of his God. In other words, this would be a person that had a sizable deformity. For whatsoever man he be that has a blemish, he shall not approach. A blind man, a lame man, he that has a flat nose, anything superfluous, or man that is broken-footed or broken-headed or crook-backed or a dwarf or a blemish in his thigh or scurvy or scabbed or a castrati, a person that has been castrated or so forth. No man that has a blemish of the seed of Aaron, the priest, shall come nigh to offer the offerings of the Lord made by fire. He has a blemish, he shall not come nigh to offer the bread of his God. Now why? Physical blemishes are the results of imperfections caused by sin. So God did not want any obvious blemish that everyone knew was the product of sin in the human race approaching him. Now, the people that had these deformities obviously were not guilty of one particular sin more than any person that didn't have a deformity. So God made a special stipulation for these men. In verses 22 to 24, those priests who had such blemishes could eat of the holy sacrifices, for their fellowship with God was not to be hindered by the effects of sin in humanity as a whole. Notice verse 22. He, that would be the person who has this deformity, shall eat the bread of his God, both of the most holy or the holy, only he shall not go into the veil nor come nigh unto the altar because he has the deformity, that he profane not my sanctuary, for I, the Lord, do sanctify them. See, these men couldn't help that they were deformed. But if they were righteous with the Lord, they could qualify to eat of the holiest of the breads. The high priest could eat it or the other priests, because their personal fellowship was not affected. But they could not, with the symbol of the blemish that they had or the deformity that represented sin, God didn't want that seen in front of him. And also, God didn't want it to be a stumbling block to the Jewish people. They didn't want the people to, because when a man is ministering, God did not want the man's deformity to be a detraction from the ministry. He wanted all the focus on the Lord and the holiness of God. Now, the high priest was held to the very highest standard of expectations in the land. Notice verses 10 through 15. He that is the high priest among his brethren, upon whose head the oil was poured, and that is consecrated to put on the priestly garments, that would be the high priest's garments, shall not uncover his head nor tear his clothes. Now, that's a fantastic statement. The commands regarding God's expectations of the priest were given in view of the fact that he was anointed with the holy oil and that he wore the holy priest, the priestly garments to intercede for the nation in God's presence in the holiest of holies. Thus, besides what was required of the people and the regular priests, the high priest was not to express the normal signs of mourning that all the others in the nation could express. Namely, He could not let the hair of his head become untidy in grief, since his head wore the holy oil of God, nor could he tear the clothes on his body in grief, for his body also wore the holy garments of God's presence. This is an amazing thing. If he happened to be the high priest, he could not grieve that way. He could not tear his clothes. Normally a person would be in grief of the loss of a father or a mother or a daughter or a son. He couldn't tear his clothes. Even if they were the regular clothes that he was wearing, he didn't have the garments that he would wear to go into the veil, because that was the body upon which he also wore the garments of God. He couldn't let his hair down. He always had to have his hair up neat. He represented the people as an intercessor looking forward to the coming of Christ when he went into the holiest of holies. So he had to have a very high standard of conduct and of self-control. Very, very interesting. He had to do it. I'll never forget the day after my father died and the day before I was planning to fly back, I had been scheduled to do a renewal of wedding vows for a couple up at Mountain Lake Bible Camp. So, I mean, they had been planning, they'd been counting on it, so I went ahead and did that. And Mike Terwilliger was up there, and I went ahead and did it. And it was pretty hard to, you know, enter into the joy of this thing. At the same time, I was still in shock over Dad's passing and so forth. But nevertheless, went ahead with it. And I was remembering the qualifications that God has for priests. I mean, the high priests, they couldn't grieve at all under any circumstances that way, because they had to keep, as the British say, a stiff upper lip. But this was required of the man, because he was supposed to represent the sobriety and so forth of the Lord. Indeed, the high priest could not approach any dead body, even that of his father or his mother, nor could he leave the sanctuary to attend their funeral if he was then serving God there. Notice verses 11 and 12. Neither shall he go into any dead body nor defile himself, even for his father or for his mother. Neither shall he go out of the sanctuary or profane the sanctuary of his God, for the crown of the anointing oil of his God is upon him. I am the Lord. Now, this doesn't mean that he could never leave the sanctuary. It means in the context, for the funeral. If his mother happened to have died during the night before the Day of Atonement, and it's the Day of Atonement, he's got to go through with the Day of Atonement. And his mother's funeral is over there, he doesn't get to go to his mother's funeral. He works for the Lord. This is a tremendous requirement that was placed upon this man. But it was something that God required of him, and it demonstrated that he was supposed to be a man who was totally committed to serving the Lord. Then his marriage partner, notice verses 13 and 14, he shall take a wife in her virginity. In other words, the only woman he could marry would be a virgin. A widow, or a divorced woman, or an immoral woman, or a cult prostitute, these he shall not take. But he shall take a virgin of his own people to wife. I think his own people means of his Levitical tribe. Neither shall he profane his seed among his people, for I, the Lord, to sanctify him. Now, that's the reason why. The high priest's son would become the next high priest. Now, if a high priest married a widow, there would always be the question that the son that he produced through that widow might have been the former husband's son. There could be that question. If he married a divorced woman, there was a question. But if he married a virgin, there was absolutely no question. That son was his, and therefore everybody knew that the man who was going into the holiest of holies to represent them was fully accepted by God. He was of the seed of Aaron. So he had to be very, very careful who he married. Had to be only a virgin and so forth. Now, we don't have that stipulation for an elder or a deacon today. A man could qualify if he married a widow. There's absolutely nothing wrong in a man serving as a deacon or an elder if he happened to marry a widow and so forth. A divorced woman, you know, because of the marital history, it's interesting that Matthew chapter 5, verse 32 says that he that marries a divorced woman himself commits adultery in the process. And the reason is, God technically does not recognize divorce. Divorce is a man-made stipulation. In God's minds, when they come together, that's it. They're one flesh until death do them part. At the death of the partner, then the other person is free. The law says that. That's what Paul says in Romans chapter 7, 1 Corinthians 7, and so forth. So the high priest had to marry a virgin. That would ensure before all that his son was truly his, and so keep the high priestly line unquestionably upright in the sight of God and man. The higher the role of the priest involved, the greater the impact of his testimony. So God required him to live with a greater degree of self-control and order befitting his role. So if God assigns us the role of exempling to a subordinate party, he expects us to exercise greater self-control and order than the subordinate does. And may we so live. When I was a student at Dallas Theological Seminary, I attended one of the classes where it was on homiletics, on how to preach. And we would take turns preaching in front of one another and so forth. And one of the fellows, one time who preached, shared a testimony of how he had been moved to go into the ministry. He sat under the ministry of a man who had graduated from Dallas Seminary some years before. He got his doctorate and everything. And one day he noticed, as the pastor was preaching, there was a man in the congregation who was absolutely infuriated with this man, and this man came up and actually slugged the pastor in the face while he was preaching. Now, this fellow was stunned, and everybody was stunned, and others, the deacons came up and grabbed the guy and, you know, took him down and got him out of the building and so forth. But he said the pastor never slugged the man back. He never said a cross word. As soon as everything was clear and the others had taken the man, he just said, okay, now where were we? And he just continued right on with his sermon. And he said that made a profound impression on him because of his self-control. He said that was one of the things that the Lord used to impress me about going into the ministry. I wanted to be like that man that I'd seen and how he had conducted himself in an exemplary way in front of a congregation under an incredibly trying situation like that. That, I think, is a real good illustration of what God's looking for. Now, this happens not only at the pastoral level and the church leadership level. If we're in a family and there are children who are under us, we're examples to the children. So we need to exercise restraint and control in regards to that. Husbands are supposed to be spiritual leaders of their wives, so as husbands, we're required to exercise restraint and control in reference to in front of our wives. In a church, we're responsible to do the same. So God has graduated standards of expectations. And it's also true, I'm finding, that more we grow in the Lord, the higher his expectations are as we grow. He expects our conduct to be better now than it was 5 years ago, let's say, or 10 years ago. So we need to keep that in mind.